Hi, everyone. I'm Debbie Statler, Editor-in-Chief of Provider Magazine, the flagship publication of the American Healthcare Association and the National Center for Assisted Living. I'd like to welcome you to this episode of Perspectives in Long-Term Care, a monthly podcast produced by ACA and NCAL. Each month, we'll talk with long-term care and assisted living professionals about the opportunities and challenges impacting the long-term and post-acute care profession. My guest today is Stan Spitek. Welcome, Stan.
Hi, Debbie. Great to be with you.
Stan is the president of Fire and Life Safety, based in Mesa, Arizona. Fire and Life Safety is a consulting firm that provides loss control, risk management, and emergency preparedness programs for providers of all types, with a special focus on long-term care facilities and senior living communities. Stan is a former deputy fire chief and fire marshal who served his community for 26 years. Stan, let's just jump in. Tell us how you began your career in emergency preparedness. Did that grow out of your firefighting days? And when did it start to intersect with the long-term care industry?
It depends on how far you want me to go back, but I'll give you the brief history. It started in first grade. I was so impacted and just mesmerized by those firefighters that came to my school for fire prevention week, and they hoisted me up on the side of the rig. And I just remember saying to myself, I want to be one of them. And fortunately, I lived in the Chicago suburbs where, like in many metropolitan areas, suburban fire departments were staffed by volunteers. So in the community that I grew up in the southwest side of the Chicago suburban area, they had a cadet program with their volunteer fire department. So I actually started as a first responder at 16 years old. Was able to be a cadet while I was still in high school, had the good fortune of being one of the community's first full-time firefighters hired in 1983. So I was a firefighter paramedic. I was the shift supervisor, so I was a lieutenant at a very young age. And 20 years came and went in a blink of an eye. And on my watch in my community, which was primarily a bedroom community, not a lot of industry or commercial base, but I had two nursing homes that were built, along with a large community hospital with several additions and renovations. I had a large continuing care retirement community that was built out of a farm field where my mom happens to live today. I had a few memory units. As fire marshal and a public official, I was involved with your industry as a code enforcement official, as a first responder, and I almost accidentally started a business when I was asked by a leader of an assisted living community who formerly worked at a nursing home that was in my jurisdiction, hey, Stan the Fireman. Nobody can say my last name, so they call me Stan the Fireman. Can you come to my assisted living community and teach the staff how to use a fire extinguisher, how to evacuate the building, how to prepare for emergencies? So, like I said, by accident, I started working with this sector of healthcare, and it just expanded. I was approaching my 20-year anniversary as a full-time firefighter. I had attained the position of deputy fire chief and fire marshal, so I was number two in a mid-sized Chicago area fire department. And I shocked everyone when I turned in my retirement papers, told them that I was going to be a consultant with the long-term care industry, did what most good Chicago area firefighters do when they retire. I moved to Mesa, Arizona. So that's where I live today. I didn't really retire. I shifted gears. I was in my early 40s. I had a passion for this sector of healthcare. I saw that I could provide some valuable perspective and guidance based on my emergency response experience, based on my former position as a fire marshal. And I just parlayed this all into a consulting business that I call Fire and Life Safety. And I became the life safety and disaster planning consultant for the Arizona Healthcare Association. I also work with the California Association of Health Facilities. And I do the same thing for Utah, as well as many other state affiliates of the American Healthcare Association around the nation. So how's that for a short answer?
I don't blame you a bit for trading some of that Chicago snow for the beautiful Arizona sunshine. That sounds like a good trade. When someone mentions emergency preparedness, I feel like folks think of hurricanes, fire, floods, weather-related items. What are some lesser-known situations that long-term care facilities would need to prepare for?
Regulatory compliance, basically CMS, says that facilities that provide skilled nursing services and even 17 other CMS provider types, they've got to have a robust all-hazards plan. So that means they need to plan for all emergencies. And you might think to yourself, how can we do that? There's a process that maybe we'll get into, but it's not just the big headline events that we see, earthquakes and fires and hurricanes, as you point out. It could be the failure of a $2.50 pipe fitting under a sink in one of your resident rooms that floods out an entire wing or the whole facility. I recently had one of my clients here in Arizona. It was an assisted living community, but back in September of last year, they're still dealing with the consequences. They had a pipe break on the fourth floor that flooded all the lower floors. And if you think that you're back in business in a matter of weeks or even months, sometimes it takes a much longer time. So we're talking about mechanical failures, technological failures, man-made incidents, civil disturbance, active shooter. I mean, I could recite to you all the different threats and perils that providers need to be prepared for. But if they embrace an all-hazards approach, they go through a process called hazard vulnerability assessment, where they actually do a risk analysis, which CMS says they are required to do to determine what specific threats and perils can individually impact them.
Let's dig into that. I know to prepare for emergency situations, you really have to have a solid plan in place before anything happened. And you mentioned this all hazards plan. Yes. How do you create a plan that applies to all these different situations or possibilities that may happen? I can think of things coming up. I'm sure the pandemic wasn't on anybody's radar before 2020, but you have to be prepared in any way. So how can facilities work on this all hazards plan?
There's several methodologies, but I'll just talk about the two main elements of developing an all hazards plan. First, you need to identify what the threats and perils or risks are. And then you've got to have a management model to manage the emergency. I think back to my time on the fire department, and I'm going to date myself to your audience, but that day when I showed up at the firehouse as a 16-year-old kid, that was back in 1977. And being a firefighter back then was pretty much put the wet stuff on the red stuff. We responded to fires. Think about our firefighters and first responders today. They respond to everything from the quintessential cat in the tree to weapons of mass destruction, to structure fires, to technical rescues, to roadway collisions, to medical emergencies. Fire departments are even billing themselves as an all-hazards agency. So knowing the threats and perils is the first step. And one of the great things that AHCA NCAL did was they developed a hazard vulnerability assessment tool that's available to members. It's a simple spreadsheet where you go through all the listed threats and perils and then grade them on what's the probability of occurrence, what is our levels of preparedness internally, our levels of preparedness externally, and that then gives us a level of mitigated risk. And based on that risk, CMS says that providers, like our skilled nursing facilities, need to focus on the perils that are identified in that risk analysis. So once you know what you have to most commonly deal with, maybe an internal fire. If you're in the West in a seismically active region, it's all about earthquake. If you're in a coastal region, one of your top hazards might be tropical depression or hurricane. But the point is this, there's no one size that fits all. Individual providers, even within the same provider group or company, at specific locations need to know what their own individual hazards are. Imagine a gas station, kitty corner from the facility. So that tanker truck is there offloading 8,000 gallons of gasoline and a fire occurs. So that's a specific hazard for that facility. And then once you know the hazards, then we talk about command and control.
once this all hazards plan is developed, I'm sure that the next step is communication. Everyone needs to know what the expected risks are. Everyone needs to know what the responses should be. Everyone needs to be trained. Like you mentioned, staff members need to know how to use a fire extinguisher. So what are some common methods for ensuring this great communication? And what are some stumbling blocks to this communication?
So communication, once the hazards are identified, needs to include communicating with all stakeholders. So that means all levels of staff, not just management. It also means informing our residents, which CMS requires, as well as family members or responsible parties. So it's a requirement that you communicate your emergency planning process to all stakeholders. And there's obvious ways that you communicate, town hall meetings, staff in services, and so forth. But once you identify those hazards, it's important that we go to that next step and train everybody on how to manage these emergencies. And that process is generally known as the incident command system. And based on the elements of the incident command system, the system has been modified for specific sectors of healthcare. For providers that work in a hospital, there's a derivative called the Hospital Incident Command System. For providers that work in our sector of healthcare, the American Healthcare Association, along with several state stakeholders, including Florida and California and some other partners, developed something called the Nursing Home Incident Command System. So the Incident Command System is a standardized framework of managing emergencies and disasters regardless of the parameters of the incident, because they're just unknown. I think of another client that had an incident in California. There was a situation where an automatic fire alarm came in at a senior living community, that the fire alarm was activated due to the fact that a resident in the facility had started his apartment on fire with an accelerant, gasoline, and that upon arrival, the fire department discovered a well-involved fire in a multi-story senior living community. And then, as the firefighters were making their way up to the second floor to fight the fire, the same resident was waiting for them with a weapon and started shooting at them, sadly killing one of the captains from the Long Beach Fire Department. So what came in as a routine fire alarm turned into a confirmed fire based on an arson that turned into an active shooter incident. You might say, how does the fire department, or how does anyone manage that type of chaos? All roads lead to the incident command system. So as members of the American Healthcare Association or any long-term care provider, there are resources out there with the Nursing Home Incident Command System that provides all the guidance needed to manage any type of emergency, including all the twists and turns that can happen.
Wow. That example was really powerful. Like you said, you started in one place and it just completely grew into another situation. It just illustrates how much you need to prepare for the variety of incidents that could arise.
Mentioning that flood that I talked about a brief second ago, the consequences of the water in inundation or intrusion in the building not only displaced the residents, but it also got into the mechanical rooms, subsequently frying out the fire alarm panel. So the point I guess I'm trying to make is that emergencies and disasters sometimes go sideways, and there are unforeseen consequences. And the way that you manage and harness those consequences through the incident command system.
What other tips and tricks do you have for senior care facilities in speaking about this planning and training portion of the process?
For the longest time, and what I mean by the longest time is probably the last 15 years, myself along with colleagues and other consultants around the country, we've really been focusing on training our management staff to manage emergencies, training leadership to be in a position to evacuate the building when the time comes, shelter in place, whatever the circumstances might be. But when we take a hard look at emergencies and disasters that have affected communities around the nation, if not around the world, and in particular, when it comes to healthcare, We know this. Leadership may be at the facility when an emergency occurs. Who's always going to be at a facility when crisis or disaster strikes? We know that frontline staff is always going to be at the facility. So the focus of myself, several of the associations that I'm working with, and even other consultants that are out there that are raising and waving the flag on emergency preparedness and long-term care, is that we need to focus on the frontline staff. I developed a new version of the training program that I have been teaching for years around the country with state associations like our affiliates that focuses on the frontline. And I call that program Think Like an Incident Commander. That means that whether you're a dietary aide, a CNA, the DON, or the executive director or administrator, if you're the first one on the scene of an emergency, and that emergency might be a resident who has fallen or a fire that's been discovered in an electrical room, you need to think like an incident commander and start utilizing the elements of your emergency operation plan immediately. Not wait for someone else to make the decision, but be trained up so that you think like an incident commander and respond appropriately.
Absolutely. Those frontline staff are so critical. Now we've planned and we've communicated and we've trained, and now something happens. An emergency occurs. You mentioned the idea of command and control. What are things that leaders and staff need to keep in mind during an emergency? And what are some common challenges in the heat of the moment when everything is going sideways?
Yep. Great question. When you've got a plan and you've got a process that you followed and you are trained on that process, it keeps you in your lane. You've got the rules of engagement. Once you know the rules of engagement and you're following a process, it often leads to a more focused, calm, and controlled response because you're following a plan. Now, certainly, there are elements of any emergency. There could be people that are injured. There could be a smoke condition that start to ramp up the emotional side of the equation. But when you're following that plan and you've practiced that plan, that's what equates to usually a very successful outcome. So that's the one thing we really haven't talked about. We talked about identifying the hazards. We've talked about communicating the plan and training on the plan. The other thing that you need to do is practice the plan. So CMS has several E-tags. Those are emergency tags. When they come in and assess a building to make sure that you not only have developed that plan that's based on a risk analysis, that you've not only trained on that plan, but you've practiced the plan. So there are requirements for drills and exercises. Certainly, every skilled nursing facility, just like every hospital or most inpatient healthcare facilities, are required to do fire drills. So they do one fire drill per shift per quarter. But under the newer CMS emergency preparedness regulations that went into force back in 2016 and 2017, facilities are required to do disaster drills or exercises. Facilities are required to do, per CMS, a full-scale community-based exercise on an annual basis. That means that they're not only doing a drill or an exercise with their own facility, but they're working with the greater community, other nursing homes, hospitals, the fire department. So CMS says that you need to do that. They also say that you need to do an exercise of choice. And that means that on an annual basis, nursing homes need to do either a tabletop exercise, another full-scale drill, a functional disaster drill, or a variety of other things, including some workshop training, so that they're practicing the plan. So if you don't practice it, you can't really expect a positive outcome. And in the data that I follow, and even the OIG in several states who have focused recently on emergency preparedness, life safety, and infection control, one of the biggest opportunities for improvement is in the training drills and exercise section. Our facilities just aren't completing meaningful exercises, and that's probably one of our biggest areas of improvement.
I love that you bring up practicing. Obviously, we're familiar with that from being kids in school and having fire drills to practice, but it's so different reading a plan or being shown something versus actually having the fire extinguisher in your hand, actually going through the steps of your plan for how to respond to different scenarios. I think that's a great point about practice.
I think about my time on the fire department. Any fire department, including metropolitan busy fire departments and sleepy rural departments, according to the National Fire Protection Association, firefighters and first responders really only do the job that they're trained for less than 10% of the time. And think about our facilities. It's highly unlikely that a nursing home is going to deal with a major catastrophic event, but it's always the what if factor. So how did we offset the fact that we weren't responding to fires or extricating people from cars all day long? We practiced and we practiced more. So that's what we need to do in our healthcare facilities. We need to ensure that we're doing meaningful training and that our exercises and drills are meaningful so that when the disaster strikes, they pay a big dividend.
And I assume that the ideal scenario is creating a circular process around emergency preparedness. Once something happens, to incorporate lessons learned into your plan, new technology that comes out, changes in your environment and risk factors. How do you close the loop? How do you take those items that may have changed and integrate them back into your plan? And how often should you be revisiting your plan and changing things?
A lot of great questions to unpack in that you threw at me there. So CMS says that following any drill, exercise, or real-world incident, you need to do a review. And that's typically called an after-action review, or an AAR, or an after-action report. And that's where you analyze your response to determine what were your strengths, what were your gaps, your vulnerabilities, and your opportunities for improvement, and to demonstrate or illustrate compliance to the surveyors that you've done some training and meaningful exercises. Typically, a state surveyor, when they come in and look at your emergency management program, are going to look for your after-action reports to make sure that they include all the elements that I just cited. But as you pointed out, there is a whole emergency management continuum that starts with mitigation, preparedness, planning, response, and then recovery. Another thing that CMS focuses on, as well as good best practices dictates when it comes to emergency management, is continuity of care and continuity of operations. We've got to make sure that we're just not focusing on planning and preparing and mitigating and responding, but the recovery is critical. But you're also compelled to maintain continuity of care and services during that recovery phase. And sometimes that can be really challenging, especially when a facility has been completely damaged or destroyed, as was the case of a nursing home in Arkansas back in 2021, where it was completely destroyed and they're just about ready to repatriate that facility. Or some of the providers that have dealt with hurricanes where their buildings are so severely damaged that they've had to send residents to other facilities. It's all about maintaining that continuity of care so that our residents are first and foremost taken care of, that they're kept out of harm's way as much as possible, and that the emergency disrupts their lifestyles and their care plans as little as possible.
Absolutely. Now that we've facilitated this circular process in our planning, let's look forward a little bit. What trends are you seeing in emergency preparedness? I read a really interesting article about a facility that installed solar panels to save on electricity costs and things of that nature, but it actually turned out to be an unintended benefit when there was a severe weather situation and the power was out. They were able to get back to operating a lot quicker because of their solar panel capabilities. Mm-hmm. Are there other projects or things like that that facilities should be thinking about long term that may affect their ability to be prepared?
The hazards aren't static. They're continuously changing. Sometimes when I start a session, especially a smaller group session, when it's focused on emergency preparedness, I'll ask the leadership team that's typically with me what keeps them up at night. And they'll tell me, typically the HR director will say active shooter or violence in the workplace. The maintenance director will worry about the generator failing. Staffing will say, do we have enough people? One tangible that I think people need to be on the lookout for are the preponderance of technology in our facilities, and in particular, the risk associated with lithium batteries. They're in everything, from the phones in our pockets to the monitors that are in the hallways to the high-tech equipment that we have throughout a facility. Those batteries need to be charged. So overcharging batteries, improper storage, these are things that are going to cause the types of fires that we hope never occur in our facilities. Being tuned in to the technological risks that are out there. One thing that I don't think we ever prepared for on a routine basis in all times before COVID was the concept of a protracted emergency. Everything, even a hurricane, comes and goes. We rebuild, we maintain continuity of care, we repatriate, and we get back to business as usual the best we can. But we never thought that an emergency would last months, yet years, but here we are. So other things, and I don't have a crystal ball, and I don't know how the weather and environmental conditions are going to change on our planet moving forward, but protracted events such as excessive heat, drought, things that you might not consider as a direct impact to the facility, sometimes it's that residual consequence of a drought, a reservoir that's down and has no water in it, a community that is suffering because of economic downturns or whatever. So it's looking at all the factors. Everything that affects our daily lifestyle needs to be considered. It's interesting that CMS, following COVID and recently in some updates to the emergency preparedness requirements as identified in Appendix Z, now state that facilities need to consider things such as staffing shortages, supply chain disruption, and a thing like a pandemic or an infectious disease outbreak as part of their HVA. And that's the great thing about what AHCA NCAL did. They developed the most up-to-date hazard vulnerability assessment tool that's out there available to your members, and that's a tool that they really want to embrace.
Wow, those are all some really great points. They wouldn't have come to top of mind, but now that you have said them, we've all seen the news about communities where maybe the water is under a boil notice, or you need to use bottled water for a certain period of time. Those things can really cause challenges to your operations.
One other thing, too, that's really on the focus of many of the departments that I work with that provide some grant funding to some of our healthcare associations. Here, for example, in Arizona, we partner with the Arizona Department of Health Services, and the association, the Arizona Healthcare Association, receives funding to prepare members for emergencies and disasters. Both in Arizona, California, and Utah, where I work in that same capacity, regulators and funders are really focused on the cyber threat. Why do we have to be prepared for that ransomware attack or that hack that is going to expose medical records, potentially compromise the operation of a facility? So cyber is also a new hazard that we need to really focus on.
Absolutely. You've mentioned CMS has several regulations and guidance on emergency preparedness. Where should folks be keeping an eye out for regulations, but also for resources and guidance for emergency planning? State level, federal level, what should they be keeping an eye on?
Certainly the information that comes out of CMS, we need to keep our finger on that pulse. And as a consultant, that's what I do for my providers and the associations that I work with. I think the associations are key. I often get invited to many of the state associations to speak on emergency preparedness, life safety, or active shooter awareness. So I think your associations are great conduits to what we need to keep our focus on. Working collaboratively with local state healthcare associations or state healthcare coalitions, they're federally funded to bring everyone together in the healthcare community, in the first response community, so that we're preparing for emergencies and disasters in collaboration with each other. Getting to know your local fire department on a more positive level. Now, certainly, the fire department hears about it when there's a complaint about a crew that responded to a medical emergency, or the facility hears about it from the fire department when they don't like how the facility handled some type of event. But outside the scope of emergency response, providers really need to know their first responders. They need to invite them in for a holiday lunch or maybe to do a tour of the facility. The last time that you want to be exchanging business cards with your first response agencies when you're in the middle of an emergency. I challenge our long-term care providers to put the onus on them to reach out to first responders and get to know them better. Why am I not saying put the onus on the first responders? They've got an entire community that they've got to respond to. They've got calls that they respond to all day. Many communities are economically challenged when it comes to staffing first response agencies that many aren't even doing fire inspections anymore. It's important for the providers to reach out to first responders, get to know them, invite them in, make sure that they know your facility, the people in your facility, and the residents. One of the things that I like the best about my former jurisdiction and that community where my mom lives today is once a year, I would meet with the residents and I would talk to them about fire safety. I would talk to them about emergency procedures and evacuation and sheltering in place. We need to make sure that our providers are doing that with their first responders as well.
That's great advice. Absolutely great advice. Thank you, Stan, for being with us. This has been a super thought-provoking discussion. Many things that I hadn't thought of before that need to be considered. So I appreciate you joining us today.
It was my pleasure. I'm happy to participate and thought it was a good conversation.
Absolutely. For more information on emergency preparedness, you can visit the AHCA NCAL website at ahcancal.org. Using the menu at the top right, select Survey, Regulatory, and Legal, then click on Emergency Preparedness. For educational courses about emergency preparedness, visit the AHCA NCAL Ed website at educate.ahcancal.org and search emergency. And we also have articles at the Provider Magazine website. Visit providermagazine.com and search emergency preparedness to find articles on that topic. Thanks to everyone for listening to this episode of Perspectives in Long-Term Care. Join us each month as we discuss issues that impact the long-term and post-acute care profession. And be sure to subscribe to this podcast on Apple, Spotify, Google, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts. Take care.